This is National Geographic Weekend. I'm Boyd Madsen. Have you ever dreamed of a little excursion on the water? If you were to picture that, the ideal vacation, what would you think? Maybe a sailboat in the Caribbean? How about a dugout canoe poling your way along the Okavango in Botswana in southern Africa? Poling your way through tall grasses, swampy water filled with crocodiles. And those are the least thing you have to worry about in the water? Well, two of our National Geographic emerging explorers have just returned from such a trip. Shaw Selby, Greg Trainish, they join us now to talk about why they were out there, what they were doing. Welcome to the show, Greg and Shaw.
Thanks for having us.
This was going to be about you weren't there for the whole expedition. This is put together by one of our other National Geographic emerging explorers, Steve Boies, to monitor the health of the system that is so rich in biodiversity and all the great wildlife of Africa can be found there. But to see it best, you need to be on the ground in the midst of it. So, Shaw, what's it like that first night when you're camping out in a marshy area and you know that hippos are in the water, elephants are in the water, crocodiles are there, and they can all come right up to where you are sleeping? Did you sleep?
Yeah, it was tough to fall asleep that first night. I heard a lot more noises that I'm not very familiar with. As you probably know, it's kind of a strange thing for an engineer to find themselves within an expedition deep into one of Africa's most critical wilderness habitats.
Even if you're experienced in the outdoors, but you haven't been in the African bush, Greg, and you spent a lot of time in outdoor environments, hiking the entire length of South America one time, the sounds are so different at night. I found myself the first time I was in the Okavango asking Derek Joubert, who I was there with, Derek, what's that sound? What's that down? Were you doing that?
I did the exact same thing. I wanted to hear and see a lion so badly on this trip that every noise became a lion to me. So every time we heard what ended up being elephants most of the time trumpeting, I would turn and say, lion, right? That one's got to be a lion. That one's got to be a lion. And it's the same thing. It was every sound, which there are so many of. Yeah, you jump. You wonder what that is. What's it mean and what's it calling for? It was incredible. Those sounds were absolutely amazing. Well, I must say, I was pretty tired after pulling all day every day. So even when there was an elephant about 4 feet outside of my tent, I sprung up temporarily and immediately fell right back.
Well, I mentioned at the beginning about on the water. This was a wilderness wetland area going through the Okavango Delta. And we talk about, you're in these dugout canoes, the Mokoros, and you have to pole through it, and it's thick with grass, so you're looking for any opening you can find, and usually those openings are made, Shaw, by hippos and elephants that have trampled through the grass and beaten the grass down to make a pathway. So when you're rounding a bend, did you ever run into one of those big creatures?
Oh, yeah. I mean, on the second day on the water was the first kind of main impact, interaction we had with one of those big animals. It was an elephant. And I just remember we pulled the Mokoros to the side, and you can hear the deep grumbling of the elephant. And my heart was beating fast, and the whole time we were waiting to see when it crossed. And little did I know that a few days later, that would be a near constant experience when we were dealing with hippos and elephants, the entire expanse. Whole time we were on the water, it was a constant thing.
We're talking with Greg Trainish, Shaw Selby, two of our National Geographic emerging explorers who were part of this expedition to monitor the health of the Okavango Delta ecosystem in Botswana and poling dugout canoes through these grasses. Greg, you had not had experience doing this, so what is it like to be pushing through this kind of environment on the pole? Is it your shoulders? Is it your arms? Your wrist? What is the hardest part of it? And how do you keep your balance? Those are not easy in the dugouts.
No, so I actually, my experience was one time around a lake in South Africa with Steve and his personal Mokoro. And then here in Bozeman, Montana, where I live, I took a whitewater canoe that my friend Evan had lent me. And I was paddling around a lake here. And, you know, when the winds would pick up, I would fall in 4 or 5 times a day. So needless to say, I was really, really scared going to the Okavango where the consequences of falling in, you just can't fall in. That's not an option. And, keeping your balance means that you're using these tiny little muscles in your ankles and your legs the whole time. So my ankles every night would swell up and would get totally sore. My hands hurt so bad from gripping the engashi, the pole that we actually used to push ourselves along, that I could not open my hands in the entire time. But it was within 1 hour of starting this trip that I got this knot in between my shoulders, and it did not go away the entire trip. It was brutal. It's fun, though. You're pushing yourself through these grasses and this biological material that's accumulated on the bottom of these grasses, and you're seeing a landscape in a way and at a speed that just nobody else gets to. It was so amazing.
And Shaw, you mentioned you are an engineer, and you've actually developed, you were part of Engineers Without Borders, and you've developed a program, Fishnet, to try to monitor illegal fishing around the world. What were you hoping to gain from this experience? What were you doing in the Okavango that was worth all of that strain to get through there and encountering this wildlife so up close?
Yeah, so what I was doing is what we came to call measuring the heartbeat of the delta. And that heartbeat is in the health of the water, which is the one thing that every wetland bird, hippo, elephant, and lion in the delta relies upon. So I was there to test the water. I did a lot of the same testing I did with Engineers Without Borders just to get a baseline understanding of the quality of that water. And then on top of that, I built sensors, open source sensors, that can monitor these water quality parameters and send that data real time live to the Into the Okavango website.
So people will be able to log on, follow the progress. And we often talk about the best disinfectant for a problem is shining light on it. Is that the hope that by constantly knowing all the changes that occur in the water quality, it'll keep it in the forefront of our mind and we'll pay more attention and perhaps monitor it and do what is necessary to keep it of a high quality?
Yeah, that's exactly what we're hoping to do. For next year's expedition, we're going to deploy a huge network of sensors throughout the whole delta. So then we'll always kind of have this understanding of the water quality and how maybe development upstream is going to impact that water quality. And we're also going to build kind of this live data logger that's going to sit on Steve Boyd's Mokoro. And the entire 10-week expedition next year is going to be all the water quality and the air quality and some other kind of exciting parameters we're looking at is they're going to be captured real time and shared for everyone who wants to see it on the website.
Well, did you get any early analysis? I know you just got back from this trip, which has just ended, but what were you seeing in the water quality?
Well, we were seeing kind of a little bit what we expected. The wetland system acts as a giant filtration system, so the water quality is actually really quite nice. We're just drinking the water directly from the delta, but we did get an understanding
Shaw, you know those elephants and hippos are pooping in that water, right?
Yeah, we do know that. We try not to grab the water right after an elephant's passed through, but you get to some areas and it's just pristine and clear, and you know that water is safe to drink.
And Greg, what were you doing on this scientifically, Greg?
Yeah, so those sensors that Shaw has developed, my group, Adventurers and Scientists for Conservation, will now send a group of volunteers out there to work alongside the Baie'i people, the local people who live in the Delta, to be able to greatly expand the reach of these sensors. So we're talking about a network of about 50 of them in the first year that will be kicking back real-time data, and our group will be responsible for maintaining and changing batteries and making sure everything's working properly. And we'll obviously be doing that in close partnership with Shaw, who's going to build the sensors, and then with Steve, who's going to be using the information from the sensors. And then there was a fourth of us on the expedition, too, a fourth emerging explorer from the 2013 class, Jared Thorpe. And Jared is actually the one who's then presenting all of that data to the world.
So it wasn't just a fun adventure, but if you're going to be on the front lines and know what is going on at the spot, in the ground, on the ground in a wilderness, or in this case, in the water in the wilderness, the only way to get there in the Okavango Delta is to pole your own Mokoro. So it can mean a few knots in the back and some sore muscles, but an experience of a lifetime. And you can check it all out on the National Geographic website. We've got pictures of this. Just look up Okavango on the National Geographic website, and you'll see these postings that Greg and Shaw have been putting up from the trip, the photographs of the wildlife that is there, and see why it is now a UNESCO World Heritage Site. It is an important place to protect. Guys, thank you very much for sharing some of the adventure with us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for it.
You know how you can have office romance where people meet just because they're in a workplace that their paths might not ever cross. They're from such different backgrounds, but work brings them together and then romance blooms. Well, it turns out that's happening in a couple of places in the wild where wolves and coyotes' paths are crossing. And they're thinking, well, what the heck, we're both here. Let's see if we can make a go of it. We'll tell you what you call a wolf and a coyote when they do breed. That's ahead. Also, this is more a story of Lonely Hearts Club. This is a blue whale circling the planet that may need the help of Match.com. All alone in the ocean. 52 Blues story. I'm Boyd Matson. This is National Geographic Weekend.